Welcome to the Sustainable Dish Podcast. I'm Diana Rogers, a real food dietitian living on a working organic farm. I wanted to let you know that I'm hard at work on a new book and documentary film project, Sacred Cow, Why Meat Belongs in a Healthy, Sustainable, and Ethical Diet. Please visit sacredcow.info to learn more and make this happen. I could really use your help, and every tax-deductible contribution makes a big difference. Now on to our show. Welcome to the podcast, everybody. Today, I have with me Jason Rountree and Paige Stanley. And the reason I have them on is because there was this really important paper that just came out, just got published. And, you know, it's a little hard for a layperson just to read this one paper and fully understand its impact, but it's a really, really big deal. And so I thought I'd invite two of the authors, Jason and Paige, onto the show to talk about the overall paper, its meaning in a broader context, and then to talk specifically about a few points in the paper that so that everyone who's listening can really wrap their heads around why eating meat is maybe not as bad for the environment as we all think. So welcome, Jason and Paige.
How are you doing, Diana? It's good to talk.
Yeah.
Hi, nice to meet you, Diana.
So Jason, let's start with you. You're at Michigan State. Can you give everyone a brief background on what you do there and your degree, and then maybe we'll do a quick intro for Paige as well.
Sure. My name, again, is Jason Rountree. I'm an associate professor of animal science at Michigan State University. I oversee two research centers for the university in Michigan here, where we look at the impact of grazing livestock on livestock grazing emissions, soil carbon sequestration. We specifically do a great deal of work on grass finishing of beef, where we're interested in just better management and adapting higher degrees of management to improve the overall footprint of grass-fed beef. We also are interested in what the nutritive value of that beef actually is. And so that's a primary a glimpse into our work. I grew up on the Gulf Coast of Texas and actually have a PhD in nutrition here from Michigan State University.
Great. Yeah. And Paige, you're out in the Bay Area.
I am. Yep. I am. I actually just recently finished up my master's of animal science working under Jason at Michigan State where this research was done. And, you know, I came from Georgia. It's where I grew up. I graduated from Georgia College with degrees in biology and economics. And, you know, I was just really interested and passionate about sustainable animal agriculture and came across, you know, Jason's research, and we built this project trying to really get a systems look at what's going on.
Great. Yeah. And so the main reasons why people complain about beef is that, you know, the emissions are so high, it's not sustainable. And then there's also complaints that, you know, particularly grass-fed beef takes up much more land than feedlot beef and has even higher emissions. And so I wanted to touch on all these things and how your paper really addresses them in one of the most concrete ways. So Paige, maybe you could give us a quick overview of the paper.
Sure. Yeah. So right now in the modeling world, most beef life cycle analysis, or which is what we call the model, when we're trying to look at the emissions from the very beginning of an animal's life to the end. So most models right now that are looking at beef, they look at grass-fed versus feedlot. And what they're using for grass-fed is continuous grazing parameters, meaning that they're looking at systems where, you know, cattle are left to, you know, range at their own leisure. And what they're finding is that feedlot systems are much more efficient, and that continuous grazing, it takes much more time, which results in much higher emissions. So what we were trying to do in this study is to use a more nuanced type of grazing that really focuses on ecological sustainability. We call that adaptive multi-paddock grazing. And we were trying to build this model in order to give a better look at what better grass-fed versus feedlot might look like.
So when you're talking about continuous grazing, those are cows, maybe, you know, you've got a group of cows that are on the same patch of land the whole time without being rotated. They can munch on their favorite pieces. And the difference between that and adaptive multi-paddock grazing, or some people call it mob grazing, some people call it holistic management. There's lots of different flavors of it out there, but basically it's moving the cattle, intensively grazing them on a small piece of grass, and then moving them so that the previous patch of grass that they were just on has a chance to rest and regenerate.
Right. And I'm sure Roundtree can maybe speak a little more to this, but essentially the goal of adaptive multi-paddock grazing is to not let them overgraze on any specific part of land, which is what can happen with continuous grazing. You know, they eat what they feel like is tasty, and then parts of the land get, you know, old and lignified, and that kind of forage can really increase methane. So what we're trying to do with adaptive multi-paddock grazing is keep them eating relatively young and high energy forages, and also give each pasture the chance to recover before bringing them back. So we're, you know, you prevent overgrazing, you prevent them from eating really old forage that would cause high methane, and we're trying to focus on regenerating the land.
Yeah, Jason, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, she did a great job. And so, you know, stepping back just a bit, you know, going back to the 19th century and you know, in Europe and other areas, I mean, there has been, you know, people that have begun to rotate their cattle in terms of grazing. And so we use the term adaptive multi-paddock just to kind of be a large blanket for the different terms that are used out today. We work closely with the Savory Institute and use holistic plain grazing at our farm, but we've also, you know, engaged with others that might have a different term. And so this is kind of a blanket term that, again, you know, establishes the fact that this is a management intensive approach that allows for, you know, a highly nutritious bite of forage, but likewise to assure adequate recovery of the plants. And, you know, what basically happens is when a cow or a steer uses their tongue and pulls that plant, effectively, the first thing that happens is the plant will shoot sugars, exudates out of the root, and those exudates recruit microbes, and those microbes flock to the base of that root and provide nutrients that the plant takes up in a process of recovering and regrowing the leaves that had just been defoliated. And so what can happen is that normally livestock can be there and have an opportunity to graze for around 3 days. And if they regraze the same plant after 3 days, it is going to stop that initial recovery. And therefore the plants don't have any more of those exudates or any more of those nutrients to help recover. And so it provides a much longer time for the plant to become more fully recovered, to be healthy, to be regrazed. And so that's effectively what can happen over time, is that we can't force the animals. We can, but in a continuous system, they may just want to continually eat those initial plants, leave the ones they don't like. The ones they don't like, they get tall, they get stemmy and ugly. And if they do eat them, again, there's not near as much nutrition in those.
Right. And when the plant is dripping these little pieces of nutrition to the microbes, that's how the carbon sequestration happens. Do you want to explain that process a little bit?
Well, sure. And it's a complex process. And Paige, feel free to chime in. But there's different aspects. There's different things that are going on, right? And we know that, you know, there is normal plant respiration through the absorption of CO2 to be used for photosynthesis. There is the liquid carbon cycle, Diana, that you just indicated. Those sugars, made up of carbon that are also going to be there. But likewise, over time, there's going to be, you know, especially through biodiversity, there's going to be greater root matter that is going to also form in the topsoil. And so we can see a growth of soil organic matter, which would actually be the dying, decaying litter from the plants, also the life of the soil, the the microbes, the earthworms, the nematodes, other larger biology that are all there. And those combined can begin to likewise build carbon that is in the topsoil.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk a little bit about the role of manure in the system? So animal waste, lots of people like to claim is, you know, toxic. We have to dispose of it. But in a system like this, the role of animal waste.
Paige, why don't you share, you know, some of the things that you found with manure emissions?
Yeah, so I think manure definitely can be a big issue, but really what it depends on is the type of system that you're managing. Mm-hmm. So if you have, you know, a ton of animals in a system where there's nowhere to put the manure, or it becomes more of a problem, more of a nuisance than something that you can utilize, then of course that is a big issue. What happens when animals are grazing, though, they're returning some of what they take out in the form of forage or what they eat back into the soil via their manure. So in this case, it really acts as a soil amendment, but without any exogenous inputs. So it's just kind of feeding into this feedback loop within the system without bringing inputs from anywhere else.
You know, it's really amazing, Diana, when we've really started to study, and what we do through our monitoring is we study how long it takes a manure paddy to be broken down. And what we found over time is that we continually see that time frame shortening. And, you know, what will typically happen is the animal will consume forage and defecate. And then almost immediately, you're going to start to see this large recruitment of dung beetles, multiple different species of dung beetles that are attracted. And they begin to plow through the manure and to spread it out. To take and to burrow and to be able to immediately deliver those nutrients back into the topsoil. And as well, you'll also see earthworms and other types of nematodes and insects really, really flock to that to help with the entire life cycle of the system. And so that's a very important, you know, component that it's part of life cycle, right? And it's part of the chain of life there. What can happen negatively then, and there are certainly technology tools and other things that we can use, whenever we have cattle that are in a feedlot, that manure becomes more of a problem than a help. And typically, especially in the upper Midwest where we have more liquid manure type systems, those manures, as we spread those back out on fields, have a greater emission factor such that they're not as more unilaterally utilized. So while we do get fertilizer offsets from liquid manure and confinement operations, I believe our model said somewhere around 30% of a fertilizer offset in a cropping system for taking manure out of a pit and spraying it back out onto a field. You're also going to have greater mechanization. You're going to have greater emissions that go up, specifically nitrous oxide and methane, that are going to make that system not as efficient on that part.
And you also get greater leaching, so greater nitrate leaching that can lead to things like groundwater contamination, which are really some of the things that we talk about when we talk about manure being a real nuisance.
And just briefly, before we dig into the meat of the paper, can you describe what happens when we don't have any animals on a pasture at all? When there's no grazing, there's no manure, what ends up happening to a system like that?
That's a great question. And the first thing is it really becomes where we are from an ecological perspective. What type of ecoregion are we in? So let's first say, like, where maybe a lot of your listeners are, Diana, up in the, you know, Northeast or in the upper Midwest, perhaps, a very non-brittle environment. We have cool temperatures, you know, good growing seasons. We have typically adequate moisture. So if we effectively take animals off the land, what we're going to see in that situation is the beginning of an early succession forest growth. We're going to see those honeysuckles and autumn olives and all those what I kind of feel like are nuisance type mm-hmm. Woody species that come in. And they're going to be the first thing that come in if we take animal impact off the landscape. And so that effectively, if we just let it go, it would effectively go back to a Forsch. That isn't necessarily wrong or right, but it also means that it is depleting obvious food security and food production. As we go into more arid environments, not necessarily desert, but just say areas that have drier, more arid environments, they're warmer, they have less rainfall or maybe just very seasonal rainfall events. What can happen when we remove animals from the land in that perspective is typically we begin to see the plants in those environments can absolutely go backwards and even die. The point being is that those grasses co-evolved with grazing ruminants. And so generally, when we remove animals from arid type grasslands, then we see the plants begin to die. We get greater bare ground, and that greater bare ground leads to more desertification. When we see higher amounts of bare ground, we also then see capping, and that ground becomes as hard as concrete. So when we do get rain events, the rain actually hits that land and it runs off. So it isn't an effective rainfall. Now, that doesn't mean that every nook and cranny of Earth or in the United States was meant to have grazing animals on it. There are real deserts. There are areas that didn't really evolve with migrating ruminants on them. And so I really, try to talk about that in the context of what grasslands are and the areas where we live that are probably actually, deforested type areas, hundreds of years ago that we now graze.
That's an excellent point, and actually brings me to something that I wanted to bring up at one point in our discussion anyway, but that is it's really difficult in a lot of this the research area to replicate one study that's been done in one area of the country in a totally different part of the world. And so that's where your adaptive piece comes in.
Great point. And we know that, and as we go, and maybe this is a good way to bridge into it, is that mm-hmm. a model is only as good as the data you put into it. What Paige and I have done in our regard is we actually populated this model with data that we measured at our farm. 4-5 years of data in some instances that we can take that data and actually populate it. So often when you look at models, not only predicting carbon footprints, but predicting climate change, there become a lot of assumptions that go into those. And, think fancy spreadsheets. And so it is important then, and what the data would show is that the greatest amount of influence on models are going to be locality and they're going to be management. And those are the two greatest things if you think about from a diversity perspective as we look at agriculture. And so while we want to take these big, global type approaches and accrue it into these big, large outcomes, really at the end of the day, it's about the local landscape and what we can do there to help improve it from an ecological perspective.
Right. And can we talk a little bit then about the land footprint? Because I think another thing that people don't realize is, when there's criticisms about grass-fed beef, that it takes up so much land, there's different ways to use land and not everywhere can be cropped. And so when we were talking earlier about what would happen to a certain area if we just left it without animals, the different land uses, will you touch on that really briefly?
Sure. I'll take a stab at this
sure.
one. I think this is actually a really important point and something that's often misunderstood when we talk about grass-fed animals. So grazing cattle are meant to, they have four stomachs, and that's kind of evolutionarily meant to digest forages. So they've kind of evolved to eat grass in that they have an entirely extra stomach to do it. So I think it really matters to distinguish what the land use is, because it's true that in actually all grass-fed cases, no matter what type of management system, that it will require more land than a feedlot system. Because when you're feeding animals corn is extremely high yielding. It requires much less land to grow. But something to consider is what that cropland could be used to do. it could be used to grow something entirely different. Whereas you can just feed cattle on grass or rangeland, which is not taking away from land that you could use to grow food direct for human consumption. And you're still producing beef to you know, not compete in this feed food competition thing. So I think it matters to distinguish what the land use is and also what you're doing to that land. Because if you are regeneratively grazing, you're not losing soil carbon if you're doing it correctly. You're not eroding soil. You can be sequestering carbon. Whereas if you're intensively cropping something, that footprint looks much different.
Right. And I think it was Nicolette Nyman. I don't know what her original source is for this, but she likes to say that 85% of cattle in America are grazing on land that can't be cropped anyway.
Right.
Is that an accurate? I'm not sure what the source of that is, but I need to email her and ask her. Is that pretty accurate?
I can't speak to the accuracy of that. I'm not sure, but I would argue that yes, much of the cattle can be grazed on land that wouldn't compete for cropland at all and wouldn't be used for cropland anyway.
Yeah. A recent study even looked at just the better end of that crop, of that grazing land. This, the better end, it was like 135 million hectares. And so, you know, you're talking 250 plus, you know, million acres there. You know, that has some level of potential. So it's really high. And so to counter and maybe counterbalance what Paige said is, so the real pull and tug of this is that when we look at a feedlot model, that it takes effectively half the land to produce the same amount of beef.
Yes.
And so that's the main challenge, right? Is that in a perspective where there is a contingency out there that would say, well, we can take this land, we can grow twice the amount of beef per unit land, and then the land that we save can be put into a forest, or it can be a wild space. Mm-hmm. And so what effectively happens is that, you know, we have this pull and tug societally of how should we view land? And there's many differing opinions out there. And I always want to hope that maybe at the end of the day that we can come to the middle. And so it's a really, you know, challenging subject.
Right. And when we're producing all of this corn, there needs to be some way of giving nutrients back into the soil. And so that's a challenge as well. How are we going to get another harvest next year, the year after that? Are we going to be using animal inputs? Are we going to be using chemical mm-hmm. inputs? And so so these life cycle analysis studies that you guys are doing, where you're looking at the entire system, what's going into the land, what's the entire impact, not just measuring emissions, are so important.
Oh, exactly. And you know, we've got to be as systematic as possible. And let's be honest first. I mean, when you look at the science of measuring carbon in soil, it's not easy. And there is many perhaps of your listeners who might be farming. I mean, we can go out to our farm and in one 10 meter square area, we have one type of soil, and then 10, 15 paces, we have a different soil. And every time we monitor and measure, you know, so we have that spatial variation. We have impacts from a time perspective, whether it's animal impact or whether it's dry conditions. And so it's, nothing's easy when trying to do this. And it's important to understand that these are our best estimates of what we think is going on. And, you know, we went and started, just to give some background, in 2012. Actually, I came to MSU in 2009. And it was really interesting. I was in Baton Rouge and lived there, worked at LSU, and survived through Hurricane Katrina and Rita in that year. And I know that many of your listeners have gone through these massive storms and see the unfortunate and brutal impact that they leave. And so I was actually working south of New Orleans, and we had massive storm surge. There was a lot of cow-calf production and citrus production there. And so what effectively evolved is I was down there within a week after the storm. We had cows running loose and everything. in a very agriculturally rich area. And I looked around and there was nothing to eat. There were commodity crops that had been damaged, citrus and whatnot. But it really got me to thinking that here we are in the land of plenty in this very, highly productive food system. And we get hit by these storms and there's nothing left for people to eat. And I got to thinking, you know, as we look and I looked around, there's just commodity crops everywhere. And we need commodity crops, no doubt. But it really started to change my thinking about what does a resilient regenerative food system look like. And that's when I stumbled upon, you know, the likes of Alan Savory and, Joel Saladin and all these other folks, Elaine Ingham, and ultimately came to MSU with an idea of having these large research centers that what does a more resilient livestock production system look like? What does a grazing system look like? And so what we did is upon getting there, the first thing we elected to do was to eliminate all of our uses of chemical fertilizers. We actually began to get rid of the dewormers and the other things. We still vaccinate our livestock. And we did that around 2010 and 11. And so we really changed our management approach. At the time we were haying, we were grazing continuously, we were haying. And so then what we did, Diana, is we went in 2012, as early as I can remember, and we started measuring soil about the time we changed. And we found, as you would expect, that the soil had a fairly low carbon stock. The grasses were modestly to lowly productive. And so that was kind of that time frame where we began to change our management. And then over time, you have students come through and Paige matriculated through. And we said, you know, we've got we actually at that point had 5 years of grass-fed data off our farm. And then, ending in 2016, we had 4 years of soil data. So we measured early on, and now, 4 years later, what do those soils look like now? And Paige, why don't you talk about that?
And also, I'm sorry to interrupt. Please tell us how you're measuring. Like, are you digging holes everywhere? Do you have these weird instruments, like spinning around every 10 feet? Like, let us know what it looks like.
Yeah, it's a giant probe that fits on the back of a ATV or a small truck or a gator, and it effectively, we can use a hydraulic probe, and it can shoot a core about a meter deep into the soil. For this project, we measured 30 centimeters, but we can also use handheld probes that you can stomp into the ground to get your soil cores. But we actually use a big hydraulic one.
Pogo stick. That's nice.
And you hit a rock.
Does it stay there, or is it a one time you're dipping it in and then pulling it out and measuring later?
Yeah, what we'll do is we'll dig a core. So we'll use this instrument. And the reason we use it is because we poke a lot of holes. And so we can lower that, go to a certain depth, and then we can take it out. And effectively, we measure by the depth of the core, 0 to 10, 10 to 20, 20 to 30 centimeters, down to a meter. And we'll split it up in whatever increment of measurement that we have. And so how we do that then is what we'll do is we'll take samples from there to measure the percent carbon that's in each of those cores. We likewise, though, that only gives us percent carbon. And so we still have to get carbon stock on a mass basis. And so what we then do is we also take separate cores and we measure the weight of those incremental cores. And that weight and known volume gives us mass. It gives us centimeter cubed. And so what we do then is we multiply the percent carbon by the mass, and that gives us an idea of the complete carbon stock in the soil down to 30 centimeters.
Okay. I think I got it. All right, Paige. So tell us what some of the data showed.
Yeah. So so there were original measurements done in 2012. And when we went back in 2016 and redid all these measurements, and we took more than 50 cores. I mean, there was a lot of data, and essentially what we showed was that between 2012 and 2016 when we resampled, on average, across all three soil types, we were sequestering around 3.5 or 3.59 tons of carbon per hectare per year, which was a large amount. It was definitely more than we're used to seeing in the models. There are a few that show similar rates, but not many. So we sampled in three different soil types, sand, sandy loam, and clay loam. Mm-hmm. And not too much variation across the three, but what we did, just because to get a better average, we took the average of all three, and that's where we got the 3.59 tons per hectare per year.
So for other farmers out there that have different types of soil, would potentially the, you know, if they did similar management techniques, would the soil sequestration, depending on the soil type, vary?
It could. In general, clay or clay loam tends to have a higher sequestration rate because of the way the soil is structured, mm-hmm. whereas sandy soils typically sequester a little bit less. So we took the median or the mean and we're really looking at sandy loam, mm-hmm. Which was sequestering, you know, around the middle, but it, to be a little bit more conservative, and we drug the mean down a little bit by averaging all three. So it really depends on the type of soil, yes.
And so then tell me, relative to methane, total methane emissions, what the impact of the sequestration is telling us.
So in the context of the overall footprint, methane for the grazing system, for AMP grazing, made up a little more than half of the whole footprint, meaning that, you know, half of all the emissions being emitted by the system in AMP grazing were methane. However, when we took into account that 3.59 tons of carbon being sequestered every year, it more than offset the entire footprint, which means that not only was all of the methane mitigated on a carbon or on a CO2 equivalent basis, but the entire footprint and then some. So meaning that we were a net carbon sink on average.
And did you compare these numbers to feedlot numbers?
We did. So within the feedlot system, there really was no room. So we were looking at the finishing stage only. And so in that context, the only place where carbon sequestration is an option is on the cropland where the feed is being grown to feed the feedlot animals. Mm-hmm. So what we looked at is, you know, what soil erosion looked like on those croplands in an area very close to us. And what we found was that, you know, actually they were eroding a lot of soil, and this is coming from literature data. So if you can't necessarily be eroding that much soil and sequestering at the same time. Mm-hmm. So what we did was we looked at how much carbon was emitted into the air from the soil that was eroded on the cropland. And it actually didn't add very much at all to the overall footprint. But what we did find is that, you know, when we were looking at a systems perspective, you know, including soil erosion and soil carbon sequestration, the feedlot system emission actually went up, you know, just marginally, just a little bit, but the AMP grazing system went way down, about 150%.
So this is a pretty significant study.
We'd like to think so.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, it's been a lot of hard work, and you know, I credit Paige with a great deal of it. And you know, there's several, if I could be hopefully not too overly pragmatic here, Diana, you know, and there's several caveats I think that need to be also stated along with this, just to temper the fact that, you know, we change systems, right, to a certain degree. And so generally there are much greater accumulations of carbon in a shorter window when you change systems. No different from a lot of your readers that choose to go on a different dietary path. And mm-hmm. in that short window, they see really great.
Yeah, they go from a 6 to a 10 in 30 days.
And then, you know, but 6 months later, a year later, things slow down, right? Metabolically speaking. Mm-hmm. So, you know, nothing's easy in this. And I think the same goes from this process. And what we can say is that in our system, with our management and our climate, we saw significant sequestration. It's been seen in Texas by the work of Dr. Richard Teague. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, there's other papers from Canada to Georgia and elsewhere that would also support our findings. In Texas, they've seen these numbers continue for 9, 10 plus years into the future. We really don't know how long we'll continue to see that rate. It could become considerably less. And I think we need to be, you know, understanding and pragmatic of that. But what this does is it actually takes real data. And it shows that through management, that grazing livestock can not only produce high quality protein, but concurrently work to improve ecosystem processes. And for right now, absolutely be able to bring CO2 out of the atmosphere and put it back into the topsoil.
Right. And Jason, you and I have talked about, it's not just about the carbon. Like that, the right. People are complaining about carbon. And so here you have it. You've got the proof now. but there's so many other benefits to grazing animals. Will you just touch upon a few other reasons why we might consider shifting grazing patterns to AMP?
Oh, indeed. And I sometimes do get frustrated that we use carbon as this metric of goodness in the mm-hmm. environmental discussions mm-hmm. because I mean, and ecosystems are highly complex. Mm-hmm. You know, they are also empowered by biodiversity and the way that water cycles through these systems and the energy they capture and just this very complex system. And we tend to, as we are humans, we tend to simplify this too much. And, you know, we use carbon as this metric of overall goodness. And I think that it's really an improper way to think about it. But unfortunately, we do tend to use carbon and carbon dioxide as this metric of environmental well-being. And it certainly is more complex than that. I appreciate you commenting on that as well.
Right. So if, you know, all healthy ecosystems have incredibly high amounts of diversity, and we're able to achieve that through producing one of the most perfect human foods.
Indeed.
In a humane way that respects the animal's life. I mean, there's just so many other good things that are coming out of this type of management system.
Oh, indeed. And, you know, we actually even, you know, just to think about it through this and, you know, we printed a paper a few years back in the Journal of Soil and Water. We, meaning Dr. Richard Teague, Ratan Lal was on that, and many others, is that, you know, we can also apply these things in cropping systems such that we can improve diversity through the utilization of cover crops and annuals and more diverse cropping rotations by using no-till versus tillage. And concurrently can also build, you know, many improving ecosystem or, you know, the ecosystem services in those systems as well. And it all goes back to the end of the day about management.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just want to add in quickly that I also think that the welfare aspect that you touched on, Diana, is an important factor. Not that it should always be considered, you know, bumped up against the ecological, but animals grazing, you know, they're getting at this evolutionary instinct that they have to graze and to ruminate. And when we put them into man-made systems where that's not an option anymore, I think we really need to consider that as a part of their overall welfare and well-being. Because, you know, what are they built to do? What have they evolved to do? And what kind of welfare do they have if we take that option away?
Right. And I like to argue I still think feedlot beef, when you compare it to maybe CAFO chicken, you know, right, where they're 100% indoors, only on grain, artificial everything, you know, at least these cows are on a feedlot or outside. They did spend most of their life on grass and they're just being finished on a feedlot. But this new level, this AMP, well, it's not really new, right? We've seen it throughout history, but this way now that we're able to really document the benefits of intensive grazing, AMP grazing, is a whole new level.
Right, I agree. You know, not to say at all that feedlots can't be humane, because mm-hmm. I completely agree. They're well taken care of. They're outside. They're well-fed, you know, for the most part, I'm sure they're happy. But, you know, this can kind of do the same thing, but also get to that, you know, natural life type of thing.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is a really great discussion too, because it, again, points to the challenges we have that, you know, we had these, you know, amounts of protein that meet per capita consumption requirements. And there's no easy way to discuss this. And I think, you know, we can point to the work of Dr. Temple Grandin and others. MSU here has a fantastic animal welfare and behavior program that has worked to make, you know, the feedlots considerably more animal friendly. And I think that, you know, we look at our ranchers, you know, throughout the United States and our feedlots, and I believe that they're working toward those endeavors as well. But as Paige indicated, you know, many times when we get back to the most natural type of ecosystem, things seem to work really well.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. We'll put a link to the actual paper for those geeks out there that want to read line by line everything else. Is there anything we might have missed at all before we go?
Go ahead, Paige.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, one thing that I think tends to get a lot of the media attention as far as beef goes is the methane aspect. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that this, another part of this paper, which I won't go into much detail about here, but one aspect of the paper was looking at how the results of methane emissions change based on how you do the calculation. Mm. And I think that's something we should really pay attention to when we look at these models that tell us, you know, methane footprint is really high, because what we found by doing a sensitivity analysis in this paper, which essentially means we were looking at how the emissions changed, like I said, based on how it's calculated. And when we compared, you know, the normal calculation, which is used in, I think, every beef model I've ever read, compared to actual data that we had on the farm from a few years ago, where we were using tracer gas, and this was actual data that was collected, we found, and many others have also found this, that the enteric methane footprint, or just methane in general, was greatly overestimated. Mm-hmm. So I think we really need to be paying attention to the methodology as well.
Yeah, and we've seen that same thing I've mentioned many times with water. So when they say how much water cattle use, are they looking at all the rainfall that fell on the pastures, or are they looking at the actual water that the cattle drank? So those are two very different ways of calculating. And so going back to the methodology of how all the numbers are calculated and really questioning every little piece is so critical.
Agreed.
Jason?
Yes, thank you. And so I think in conclusion, you know, we've provided, you know, a paper that is reflective of our work that would suggest again that there are great benefits to placing ruminant animals in these grassland and even tame pasture environments. But I think at a greater level is, you know, what can we do with this data to make greater change both domestically and globally? And to me, that's where I want to see this head, is that can we begin to see more grazing management across the millions and millions of acres of land that is currently continuously grazed? Can we likewise then, you know, take that and improve our overall footprints of beef? Can we likewise, you know, use technologies and really more management strategies that improve the footprints on our cropping systems as well? And I think for us to have a greater, more resilient food system, we're going to need to see the technologies and the management that we already know about, and we need to see that aggregated throughout the United States. And so that's something that I'm hopeful that just our data can maybe help just to give big companies or policymakers a little more idea of what the potential benefits are of looking at more of these regenerative type farming practices.
Yeah. And another point to that is many of the producers I've talked to who use these methods have much higher land to cow ratios than what continuous grazing reports. And so for the folks that are saying, well, you know, it takes, you know, X amount of land per cow, that's not necessarily true. If you're looking at this AMP model, most producers, at least that I've talked to, I don't know, Jason, if you found the same in yours, but there's, and I, of course, this depends on location too, if we're talking about a humid environment compared to a brittle environment, but the results is more beef per land.
Exactly. And in fact, in Paige's model here, I believe that we were 150% less land in our grass-fed model versus many that were already in the literature. Is that number right, Paige, around there?
I don't remember that number off the top of my head. I would have to go back and look. But what I do remember is that our cattle finished in much less time at much higher weights and with much less land. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing, you know, is this is extremely beneficial for a rancher. You know, so increasing soil carbon, increasing soil biology and soil health, and really paying attention to the environment also has really important impacts as far as farmer productivity goes, because healthy soil means healthy forages and more of it. And that also means you can fit more cows. And you know, that's a higher payout for the farmer. And so I think that could be used as a really powerful incentive to talk to farmers about why this could really be important.
And also can help the argument, or how you going to feed the world, right? Because it always comes down to, well, you know, how are you going to be able to apply this to, you know, everyone's beef? And it's a slow process to get there. But, right. I've had conversations with other experts that feel that it's definitely possible.
Indeed.
Yeah. Great. Well, Jason, I look forward to seeing you at the Grass-Fed Exchange. And Paige, it was so nice to meet you. I look forward to talking to you more in the future as well. Thanks so much for being on the show, everybody. And I'll put a link to the paper. Will you mention the publication and the title for those that are just listening and want to research it themselves?
Sure. It's the title of the paper is called, let me scroll up, Impacts of Soil Carbon Sequestration on Life Cycle Greenhouse Gas Emissions in Midwestern USA Beef Finishing Systems. And that's published in Agricultural Systems.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much, guys. Have a great day.
Thanks. Diana.
Take care.
Okay. Thanks for listening, folks, and don't forget to visit me at sustainabledish.com to learn more about how to work with me, check out my latest posts, and visit my store. See you next time on the Sustainable Dish Podcast.